Good morning and welcome to Behind the Soundbite. With us this morning is Thomas Frank. Tom is the author of What's the Matter with Kansas? A critique of the right-wing insurgency in America. He's a founding editor of The Baffler, author of One Market Under God and The Conquest of Cool. He's a frequent contributor to Harper's, The Nation, The O'Reilly Factor, and Behind the Soundbite. Is that a shameless plug or what? Well, Tom, you there?
The O'Reilly Factor?
Oh, I had to throw that in so we would be fair and balanced.
Oh, right, right, of course.
Well, welcome.
I was on there once. Come on, guys.
Well, you've only been on our show once, too. But
this is twice now.
Tom,
yeah, this
welcome
is twice.
Back.
You got O'Reilly beat already.
I don't know where to start today. Your book, Observations on the Election. We talked to you before the election last time.
Yeah.
Terry Schiavo, the deficit, permanent tax cuts, the war on Social Security, the war on pensions.
Oh, my God. It goes on and on, doesn't
Bolton,
it?
Bolton, Wolfie, Michael Jackson, or today, I guess it's Pat O'Brien. Or how about Sharon's wall around Palestine? Could we get one of those around Washington?
Don't forget the propaganda news service paid for by the taxpayers.
That, too. Yeah. And what about the Red Sox? The team jet circling the globe, kidnapping terror suspects as part of the CIA's rendition program.
Yeah.
Where's George Mitchell?
Are you saying they're sending the Red Sox to Syria? Is that what you just said?
The Red Sox jet has been seen participating in the rendition program, if you can believe
that. Is that true?
Yeah. It was in the news yesterday.
And wouldn't that suck? And imagine if you were one of those guys, like some Canadian dude that they decided to render to Syria or some country that has torture, and you rode over there on the Red Sox jet.
Maybe you get to meet Johnny Damon on the way.
Wouldn't that be terrible?
You guys sound like, what they say about liberals. They hate America. You're just pointing out the flaws. And what do you think about that?
Tom, why do you hate America, Tom? Can we start with that?
Well, here's my answer to that. So I just went out the other day. I turned 40. I turned 40 years old. And I went out and bought a gas grill. I went to Home Depot and I bought a gas grill. And then a friend of mine drove in from Kansas, his car loaded with an inch and a half thick porterhouses.
Mm.
And we had all my friends over, and we cooked a huge quantity of red meat. And I don't see how you could possibly say that I don't love America.
Well, you're probably drinking some foreign beer, though, over there.
I was drinking Iron City beer from Pittsburgh.
Good man. Where do you live?
Right now I live in Washington, D.C.,
Oh, well, forget
and I apologize
it.
For that.
Forget it.
There's your critique right there. Ann Coulter, I'm ready.
Well, on a serious note.
Scold me.
Tom, on a more serious note, what is your famous reality show?
My reality show?
What's your favorite?
I haven't set up a reality show yet.
Oh, okay.
Now, there is a baseball player. We could have one of the all the different guys named Tom Frank. There's a baseball player, Thomas.
Yeah, there is
there's
a baseball player.
A guy that writes for the New Republic called Thomas Frank.
It's Tommy
and there's
Frank.
An editor of the New York Daily News called Thomas DeFrank.
You have many lives.
And I've been confused with all of them.
What about
Tommy Frank? Even the Big Hurt.
General Tom?
When I lived in Chicago, I used to get his fan mail sometimes.
Mm.
They would deliver it to my house instead.
Well, you're a lucky guy.
Yeah.
Hey, what have you been doing since last time we talked to you in August? We've seen you on television, and your name comes up in the newspaper all the time, Wall Street Journal, New York Times. What's been happening?
Well, the election sort of changed people's reaction to the book, because suddenly it was, and now in the aftermath of the election, there's things like the New York Times is running stories about, what's going on in the Kansas State School Board, and the Washington Post is doing. I mean, and people are taking this stuff seriously, finally.
So you put Kansas on the radar screen.
Even the Wall Street Journal had an editorial. Well, it wasn't exactly for you, but you saw that one.
No, I didn't.
It's on the website. Maybe it's an old one. I don't know. I saw it last night. But they said you come from a super rich family and you're just a spoiled kid and you just don't like America.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
I gotta check that out.
Yeah, and Kansas is doing great. The economy, they have the best employment record in the nation and everything. It's all there in the Wall Street Journal. Now that's a very reputable editorial page.
Yes, that's right. And you know, I used to have a lot of fun with the Wall Street Journal editorial page in my previous book, One Market Under God, and it was I don't know how I missed that because I read them every day, but they were a lot of fun back in the day. They used to publish this guy James Glassman, author of Dow 36,000, and that wasn't enough. Then they would publish, you know, Larry Kudlow about Dow 50,000, and you know, just go up and up. The sky's the limit.
Well,
the
there's a couple of people
was,
that are upset about
stay.
Your books. And there's a couple of people out there, but you've been compared with Mark Twain and H.L. Mencken. What do you think of those comparisons?
I mean, it's very flattering. H.L. Mencken is my great hero. You know, I read H.L. Mencken all the time. He's the North Star. Well, actually, politically, I disagree with him. You know, his politics are kind of bogus, but his writing style is just, you know, he was the best.
He had a mouth greatest. And a pen, I'll tell you.
Yeah, and Twain. I mean, Twain is a deity. Compare anybody to him is silly. You know?
Well, I think the fact that you can write with humor about the serious problems is one of the accolades that fits.
Yeah. Thompson. Well, all of that stuff is very nice of people, but I'm not buying it. You know, I'm going to retreat back to my super rich family. Did someone really say that? That's hilarious.
Well, you came from a upper class neighborhood. You know, one of those Jaguar liberals or something. I don't know.
It's probably O'Reilly who said it.
I'm actually thinking about getting a getting a Cadillac. You know, now that my book is successful,
I thought you had one.
I can get one secondhand. You know, you can get them for fairly cheap.
Tom, has the book has the sales fallen off or got improved since the election?
After the election, it sold pretty well. But you know, that was some months ago now.
Well, the book, I read it last August when it came out. I reread it shortly for this, and it's kind of remarkable in the prescience of what has happened since the election.
Yeah, you know what bugs me and amazes me is that this was not, it's a history. It's not a prescient book. I wasn't looking forward except for in the very last paragraphs. It was about the past and about the way that, you know, conservatism works and the kind of operation that it performs, and that it always comes back to class war. It always comes back to issues of social class, like the Wall Street Journal editorial that you're mentioning, talking about me being from a rich neighborhood, which I discuss at great length in the book, because in my neighborhood, people do read the Wall Street Journal, and the owners of Kansas City were my neighbors when I grew up. It's a history. It goes back to the late '60s, and they always do this. Conservatives always come back to the backlash. This is their default campaign position. And what's amazing to me is that the Democrats, this always takes them by surprise. It's always a shock to them that they're doing this again, and they did it again this time. I mean, they did it in a huge way this time. And the Democrats did not have a response. In fact, they walked right into it. I mean, John Kerry was probably the most, one of the most vulnerable guys they could have chosen to the kind of backlash appeal. He's the richest man in the U.S. Senate. He's a, Boston aristocrat, and he really is, he really is. He's married to a very wealthy woman, and he is, he's a sophisticated and polished person who does speak foreign languages. And I was recently reading a backlash book from 1972, called, I've got it here in front of me, The Rise of the Unmeltable Ethnics. And I'd never read this before. I just got it, yesterday. I started reading it. And it actually attacks John Kerry in 1972, for being these things. You know, this has followed this guy around his whole career. And they weren't ready for it. And there's no excuse for that. They didn't see something like the Swift Boat veterans. They didn't see that coming,
What should they have done?
Well, first of all, they should have nominated a different guy. Mm-hmm. The whole problem. I mean, Kerry was okay on the issues. I liked him on the issues. I voted for him. I didn't have any problems with him on the issues. But they have to choose somebody who can speak to working class people. I mean, that's what it's all about. The Democrats are losing their core constituency. I mean, they're hemorrhaging their core constituency, and they don't do anything about it.
Who would you put up there? I mean, such as who?
Well, I didn't really like any of them. I mean, I thought Howard Dean was pretty good.
How about Tom Arnold?
Tom Arnold. You know, as long as you're going to fail, at least go down swinging. You know, put up a guy like Howard Dean. At least he's a fighter. You know,
yeah.
He probably couldn't have talked to them successfully either. John Edwards could have done a little better job, but they need to start afresh, and you need to, you know, move away from the whole crop of centrist Democrats, and they have to rediscover their core values and, you know, who they are as a party, who they speak for. They have to do some serious thinking and reconsider that stuff. The whole DC centrism thing is a poison pill. It's the kiss of death.
We want to remind our listeners that they should call in. This is a call-in show, 469-0500 or 866-625-9378, 866-625-WERU. Thomas, your thesis pretty much can be summed up in how to keep the middle class, especially, or people in general, preoccupied with the quote-unquote moral issues, abortion, homosexuality, and now Terri Schiavo. Steve and I have a friend down in Portland. He's, in fact, two friends down in Portland that are computer programmers. She's a graduate of MIT with honors, and they're both unemployed. And yet they are taken with this Terri Schiavo thing and very much, you know, for what Congress is doing.
They're
completely diverted, but they haven't been employed for a couple of years.
Yeah. Well, I've heard stories like that for, you know, ever since the election of people who are, you know, struggling, don't have health insurance, living hand to mouth, you know, very extremely poor, all this sort of thing, and voted for Bush anyway because of the moral values issues. It's really disheartening. Look, the moral values issues, they're powerful for very obvious reasons, for the same reasons that the media loves to talk about them. Remember in the 70s, sometimes I think we're living through this endless replay of the 1970s. Remember the Karen Ann Quinlan stuff?
Yeah.
People were fascinated in this kind of morbid way by that case.
Elian Gonzalez. That was another one. Elian Gonzalez.
Yeah, that's another one. And this is, you know, it's the same thing being replayed, but with a lot of political grandstanding, which you didn't have so much of in the 70s, or as much of.
But it keeps our mind off the real issues. So we're really waiting for some calls here, because I'm sure we've, you know, our audience here, I have to admit, it tends to be on the liberal side. So even though we'd like to get, you know.
People don't like America.
Well, right. At least to get them activated, because we're trying to broaden our listener base by having people on the other side listen. But if they can't, if they won't, then let's activate the listeners that we do have.
Also,
I'm ready to do that.
Okay.
So, you know, radio with the listeners that you do have, not the listeners that you wish you had or the listeners that you might hope to have at a future date.
Well, Tom, how do you frame this?
That's a joke, guys.
Okay.
We have what we got up here. And we'll have to work with our listeners, I guess.
Yeah. You should have, you know, consciousness-raising sessions and stuff like that.
These armchair liberals.
We usually hold hands while we're doing the show. We do have a caller. Are you there, caller?
Yeah. This is Dick at Southwest Harbor.
Hi, Dick.
Hi.
You got a question for Tom?
Well, yeah, I've got actually two things. The Red Sox jet bit, that jet, I don't think, is the Red Sox jet as such. It's owned by one of the owners, and he just has this jet which he leases out through a company, and he says he doesn't, you know, get involved in who leases it, particularly and the guys who run the leasing say they don't care where it's going either. And he puts the Red Sox emblem on it sometime, he says, just because he likes the team. But it doesn't sound like it's the official jet. I'm beginning to think that maybe the CIA just basically leases a bunch of these things as fronts. You know,
right.
It has nothing to do with who's owning them, but just so that they're not the ones who are running it. Sort of like, was it Air America in the old days?
Right. Mm-hmm. They should put a Disney World. The guys will think they're going to Disney World.
Well, it's the thing.
I have morbid humor today.
Well, is it possible to be otherwise? I mean, there. I'm, one of the things I'm wondering about the idea that the people, like the people in Kansas, you know, they seem to be voting against their own interests and are anti-union. But I'm just wondering whether the problem is that a whole part, at least in the Harper's version of your book, I haven't had a chance to read the book. I read the Harper's article, though, that there's a sense that unions are bad among people, and I'm wondering if it's because this common conception that unions try to force up wages, which under the current circumstances then induce the employers to lay everybody off and move somewhere else, and that as such it's not, they don't think they're voting against their own interests, that they feel that the unions basically are a not so veiled threat to them, that if they come in and actually win, well, then they lose their jobs.
Yeah, that's and you know, a lot of things like that can be, that's what management says when, you know, when unions ask for a pay raise or when people try to organize. They say, well, if you organize, you know, we'll have to move the factory somewhere else because then you'll demand too much money and that sort of thing. It's a very common way of thinking about it. And what's uncommon is for workers themselves to think that way. But
sure, aren't we seeing
more? Of
course
it could happen. That's you know, that's very common. In fact, when I talk about free market economics being bad for people, look, the people who write the Wall Street Journal op-eds and who staff CNBC and this sort of thing, they don't think that. They think that the free market is fantastic for everybody, and that, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats, and, you know, we have to totally submit to the free market forces, and then we will all be prosperous and rich. But the thing is that's you can read editorials making that claim any day of the week in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. As I said, the thing is that it's unusual for average people to believe that. That's pretty much that's the opinion among the kind of journalistic. I'm trying to avoid using the word elite here. The pundit set. This is what my previous book was about. One Market Under God. You should check it out. Debunking the sort of free market religion.
I can understand debunking it, but I'm just wondering if the sort of our assumption that these people are crazy, that the working class is crazy now, operating against itself, isn't that in a way we're ignoring the fact that this is a very real part of reality at this point, and that it's not just that the pundits and the Wall Street Journal op-ed writers are saying it, but in fact that's what businesses do under these circumstances.
Yeah. Well,
so it's not.
It would be a good argument, except for that, like I said, it's not. Average people that I met and talked to don't believe the free market faith, and I'll give you, and this is why they're brought into the Republican coalition with the social issues. For example, every farmer I talk to from Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, it doesn't matter. As long as you're talking to small farmers, they understand the fix that small farmers are in. They know what's killing small farmers, and it's monopoly. It's concentration in the agribusiness sector, and they're aware of this. And every farmer I've talked to, they know instantly what I'm talking about. And the free market people, and they're against it. They're against it. You know, this is killing them. It's killing their way of life. You defer people in favor of it. They think it sucks. It's like the Bush Ag Department or, you know, your various agricultural school ag economists or, you know, people like that, they're in favor of it. They believe the free market forces are best for everybody.
But don't you both?
But then the mystery is you talk to those farmers and they totally agree with you on the economic issue. You know, they agree with me on the economic issue, the liberal side on the economic issue, and they say, well, who did you vote for? And they're like, well, I voted for Bush. Well, why? And that's the question. And then there's countless other examples. Like in Kansas, we had numerous examples of the sort of corporate malfeasance, you know, corporate leaders running amok, ripping off shareholders, this kind of thing. I mean, it was everywhere. It was in the headlines all over the place. You talk to anybody on the street, you know, in Topeka or wherever, and they're hopping mad about it. They're furious about it. And then you say, well, who'd you vote for? Well, I voted for Bush. Because they don't see any connection between those between the economic issues and the politics. For them, the politics is about morals. Which candidate is more like them? Which candidate is closer to home?
Hey, Tom?
I talk way too much.
No.
Really,
you're
sorry.
You're a great guest. I pulled this quote. I don't know. I think it's out of your book, but it says, deregulation leads to monopoly, monopoly to the abuse of power and centralization of capital. Some measure of regulation is necessary to combat the inherent guiding principle of capitalism, power.
Yeah, who said that?
Did you? I think it was Adam Smith, the father of capitalism.
Yeah, he wouldn't use the word regulation, I don't think.
Okay. Well, anyway, Dick, thank you for your call.
Okay,
thanks for calling. There's one other aspect, what conservatives are doing is creating a digression. In this morning's Bangor paper, there's the ethically challenged House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. And I'm quoting the paper now.
Yeah.
And he's standing up very piously for Teresa Schiavo, when actually, you know, the man is probably under indictment for a series of things. Once again, you could talk economics, but it's also, a digression?
And there, the Republicans are fairly open about that to divert public attention away from DeLay's troubles right now, that he's suddenly come to Jesus. He sees the light.
Mm-hmm.
Also, conservative culture tends to be emphasize forgiving. A guy like George Bush, you know, we all know he had his racy past, but he's atoned for it, and they welcome him, they forgive him.
I'm surprised they haven't brought in a faith healer here. I'm sorry to have said that.
You know, one of the issues that just blows my mind is that after Bush won the election, and polls confirmed that he wanted, you know, moral values were incredibly important in this election. That instantly, what does he emphasize when he gets back in office? Is he gonna, when he starts his second term, is he gonna make America a more moral land? No, it's Social Security privatization, medical malpractice, the bankruptcy bill. He's gonna change the tax code. You know, he's just basically giving, their agenda is give corporate America what they want. You know, give the business roundtable what they ask for. That's it.
Okay. Hey, Tom, let us break in. We have another caller.
Am I talking too much again?
No.
But we want to get our caller in.
Hi. I'm calling from Brooklyn. And
what's your first name?
Laura.
Laura, glad to have you.
Thank you. I have a hard time when I hear that Bush won the election, because I really don't think he did. Exit polls have always been accurate within a fraction of a percent correct, besides all the other manipulation that was done, where there wasn't enough voting machines, people waiting hours, people being registered, and then having the Democrats thrown off. So I believe the election was stolen for the second time in a row.
Is that your comment?
That's one of them.
Okay. Tom, you got
a reaction to that?
I haven't studied any of that stuff, and so I don't have an opinion. I assumed the election was fair and square.
You see what we have to deal with up here, Tom?
We got a bunch of
skeptics here.
I can't believe it would be the story of the century, wouldn't it?
I don't think, from everything I've seen, statisticians have gone through it, and it wasn't feasible that he won.
What's your second
point?
As far
as the expulsion. And the second thing is, I have a hard time with moral values when 100,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed, and we've used depleted uranium, which has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. Cancer rates are way up in children. That's affecting genetic material.
Sure.
So I think that's a destruction of Iraq, and we used it in Afghanistan.
That's a great point.
And we're also breaking international law. That is a weapon of mass destruction, as well as cluster bombs and daisy cutters.
Right.
And so moral values. Everything that I hear, like when I hear George Bush say something, like he called Saddam Hussein a homicidal maniac. I think, well, that's what he is, because...
All right, you're going too far now. We're going to have to cut you off, Laura.
I'm very serious about it.
Tom, you got any response?
Well, you know, of course it's hypocrisy when these people talk about moral values. But it's a term that means something to them. The reason that the poll used that term was because that was the Bush campaign slogan. I forget what it was. You know, I have it around here in my office somewhere. But the poll question deliberately used Bush's campaign slogan to see who voted for him based on that idea, and it was a surprisingly large number of people that believed. And look, this is you know, Bush is not a man of the people. He is not a proletarian. But he seems like one. And when he would, you know, he talks to blue-collar audiences, and people always come away saying, he's one of us. And the reason they say that is because they believe he shares our values. That's what they always say, he shares our values. That's what it's all about. And that's totally crucial, that perception of Bush, whether it's, you know, true or not. I mean, I don't...
Tommy, your callers are backing up here.
Yeah, I watch Bush on TV, and I say to myself, you know, I disagree with everything he does, but he's probably a really nice guy. And then you find out he actually isn't. He's really not a nice guy.
Laura, we don't think it's
like one.
We're going to take the next caller. Another call.
Hi.
Yes.
Jenny. Hi.
Where
are you
calling
today?
From? And what's your first name?
I'm Jenny, and I'm from Sedgwick, and I call in to this radio station a lot.
Welcome to the program, Jenny.
Yes, thank you, and it's been great listening to Mr. Frank. I have a question. It's kind of two parts, but how do we remedy this, and how do we convince people that are voting for Bush for what I think are all the wrong reasons, but that's only my opinion, that he really is basically screwing them to the wall? And or is it that you can't convince them, and we're just going to have to kind of watch this play out?
That's the question.
And that's the question, and I'm going to get off
the
phone and listen to you.
Now,
okay?
Let me put it this way. The way that the Democratic Party is heading now, they're going to continue to be beaten. What they have to do to make this stop and to show people that Bush is screwing them to the wall is, as I said, they have to return to their roots in some way, and they have to adopt the economic populism that made them the party of the people in the first place. Okay, they have to go back to the way to Roosevelt, to Bryan, to Truman, and they have to think and act that way. You can't have a reform party that's run by the upper classes. It cannot work. I mean, there's countless historical examples.
Are able to actually compete in politics to become politicians.
Well, that's a huge part of the problem. But what that means is that then, you see, the thing that made the Democrats a liberal party in the first place was not, you know, a lot of nice, enlightened people from, you know, with good educations. It was working class people. And we have to figure out how to get them back into. I mean, working class people are in politics; they vote, right? But they're subject to all. You know, it's just like, here's a guy that talks with the Texas accent; he's your guy, you know. And there has to be something real. The Democrats have to offer something real to shut down that Republican fake populism.
Let's hold on that thought. Yeah, and thanks for your call.
Is it time to run all the ads
thanks,
now?
Well, we're gonna play a special little song that Steve has picked out. Is that
this is Behind the Sound by WERU. We'll take about a 3-minute break, and just hold on to that thought, Tom. We'll get right back to you. Thanks.
Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign, sitting there by the left turn line. Flag on the wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him, the VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. See those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, 'cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the squares, a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. And the bar is still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar is light and the register's low. The bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd's getting thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage don't pay for a roof. Don't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, just try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far $5.15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore. There's a high school girl with a bourgeois dream, just like the pictures in the magazine she found on the floor of the laundromat. A woman with kids can forget all that. If she comes up pregnant, what'll she do? Forget the career, forget about school. Can she live on faith, live on hope, high on Jesus or hooked on dope? When it's way too late to just say no, you can't make it here anymore. I'm stocking shirts in the Walmart store, just like the ones we made before, except this one came from Singapore. Guess we can't make it here anymore. Should I hate a people for the shade of their skin, or the shape of their eyes, or the shape I'm in? Should I hate them for having our jobs today? No, I hate the men sent the jobs away. I can see them all now, they haunt my dreams, all lily white and squeaky clean. They never known want, they never known need. The shit don't stink and their kids won't bleed. Their kids won't bleed in their damn little war, and we can't make it here anymore. We'll work for food, we'll die for oil, we'll kill for power, and to us the spoils. The billionaires get to pay less tax, the working poor get to fall through the cracks. So let them eat jelly beans, let them eat cake, let them eat shit, whatever it takes. They can join the Air Force or join the Corps if they can't make it here anymore. That's how it is, that's what we got. If the president wants to admit it or not, you can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo, look us in the eye, call us on the cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the great high plains, it's done closed down along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. And dust devils dance in the noonday heat, and there's rats in the alley and trash in the street, gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
That's James McMurtry. You can't make it here anymore. And this is Behind the Soundbite with Chuck Osherman and Steve Savage. I guess this morning is Thomas Frank. Tom, welcome back.
How you doing, guys? You still there?
We're still there. That's kind of a refreshing song.
Refreshing?
Sums it up.
Yeah, all that, but, you know, the Terry Schiavo, and, you know, there are other issues on the table, right, besides all that other stuff.
Yeah.
We do have a couple calls lined up. Caller, you still there?
Hello.
Hi, welcome to Behind the Soundbite.
Hi, thank you.
And your name and where are you from?
I'm Kathy from Waldo.
Okay.
And Tom Franks, incidentally, I read your book. We were in a study group, and we found it to be sort of jaw-dropping as we read it. Nevertheless, I was intrigued by what you said about the candidates that the Democrats continue to put up, that they've moved away from their base, which historically was not in the upper echelons of the socioeconomic picture. And yet, we had Dennis Kucinich as an early candidate for the Democratic nomination. Here's a man who lived part of his life in a car. I mean, did you, Tom Franks, pay any attention to the Kucinich candidacy?
No, I didn't, and I probably should have, but it's because when he totally slipped my mind when I was saying that he. When the primaries were going on, I was actually writing the book, and so I really didn't have I really didn't pay a lot of attention to it at all. Now since then, I've read a lot. You know, it's like, for example, the Dean scream. I missed it. I've never heard it, and everybody talks about, you know, Dean is you know, he's got this problem and that problem, and you know, I have no idea what they're talking about. So, but I do, you know.
So you have looked at subsequently, you have looked at Kucinich's candidacy and what he had to say.
I think he was good on many issues. Isn't he a vegetarian?
I don't know if that was ever an issue in the campaign. Was that an issue in the campaign, what you ate?
No, I was joking.
It should be.
Okay, so you were joking.
Yeah.
He definitely was articulating a working class platform and a platform that criticized very heavily the will to empire by the United States.
He was ridiculed in the mainstream media, and I think that's why he never got anywhere.
Made fun of his looks and whatever.
I'm sorry?
Well, you know, the fact that he wasn't tall and he wasn't one of these handsome Hollywood-looking type, you know, we're going on appearances rather than, you know, the gut issues.
And that's Tom's point.
That whole thing leads me to my next question, which came out of reading your book and also Don't Think Like an Elephant. Are you familiar with that, George Lakoff?
I've got it here. I haven't read it yet.
Yeah,
it's
it's
on my desk right now.
It's a great follow-on to your book, Tom. But, you know, reading yours and Lakoff and what you just said about Kucinich wasn't tall and he was, you know, all that peripheral nonsense leads me to say, is there any hope? I don't see much hope when you consider that you have an electorate that looks at George Bush and believes that he represents morality when his past 4 years has already debunked that. And to say that it's morality that is driving people to accept this person or these people who are leading us, there's no hope of using logic or even reframing to bring these people to a real examination of where we are. So I'd like you to just talk a little more about Kucinich and the idea that you cannot use logic or reframing on people who see morality where there is none. So you can talk about that now.
Kathy, what do you think about Connie and Hillary going at it for the... In the next election.
Hillary and who?
Who else than Hillary?
Condoleezza Rice.
Condoleezza Rice.
Oh, wouldn't that be funny? Hey,
of course, I think Condoleezza Rice is a tool. You know, she's perfectly willing to be a tool. going around the world as the school marm, shaking her finger at all the people, all the countries that are not doing what we want. That really endears her to lots of people, especially outside of this country, who are already fed up with the shaking finger of the United States. And Hillary Clinton, who originally was a Republican from a very wealthy suburb in Chicago, and according to her book, Hillary's Choice, it was a civil rights struggle in the United States, and the fact that a church that she attended had someone come in to talk about the civil rights struggle and had some kind of an epiphany.
We're going to break you off here. Sorry? Let's get back to your original point, Tom. If there is a viable candidate, a dean or a Kucinich.
I don't know much about Kucinich, so it's, you know, I'm sure he's a great guy, and I can't speak to that, but I can say that I don't write people off. I think that a lot of the voters who, you know, a lot of the Bush voters can be reached, and I think that it's the leaders can't. I mean, a lot of the people that I interviewed for the book are too far gone, but many of the people, the rank and file, you know, conservative voters, sure they can be reached. As I was saying when we had that earlier caller, we were talking about farmers and other, you know, economic issues. These things actually have real appeal to grassroots voters who went for Bush. This is the sort of famous, poll after poll after poll confirms this, that yes, working class, a lot of working class voters are conservative on social issues, but guess what? They're liberal on economic issues.
Well, it would
These
be
people
ironic.
Used to vote. Sorry?
It would be ironic if it was the true conservatives that actually saved the Democratic Party.
Yeah. Well, the conservatives appeal to them with their culture war issues, and if the Democrats want to appeal to them, they have to appeal to them with economic issues. Now, the problem is that, A, they don't do that anymore because they don't want to be on the left on economic issues, because that gets you at odds with the corporate donor, with the wealthy donor community. Mm-hmm. And B, when they are on the left on economic issues, they don't talk about it. And so you have instances like this latest campaign where Kerry was demonstrably better than Bush on economic issues, speaking from a sort of a left perspective. Kerry was better, but he didn't talk about it on numerous things. And they poll voters. Another thing, when they poll voters that they find all the time, and this is the one that really breaks my heart, by and large, voters can see no difference between the two parties on economic issues. And if that's the case, if economic issues are off the table, then all you've got left are those culture war issues, and you're going to lose working class voters on those issues.
How about states' rights issues? You know, in the Chicago case.
Yeah, let's bring that one.
Yeah, that's
back.
traditionally a conservative issue.
We all know that's just it's always a fig leaf for something
else. We have another caller waiting, and we bring that one on. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, my name is Laurie, and I'm from Stonington. And actually, what I had to say sort of ties into what you're saying. I feel as though the media is letting us down, not pointing out what hypocrites Republicans are. And a perfect example is this Terri Schiavo situation, where people who are standing up there grandstanding about a nation's value being demonstrated by the way it cares for its most helpless, just a week ago voted to slash Medicaid, which I assume is what is providing this health care for Terri Schiavo. And the only media besides, the only radio station or format that I heard this pointed out was amazingly on Marketplace last night.
I don't know what they've done to Medicare, but they also reformed bankruptcy last week, mm-hmm. or 2 weeks ago. When I say reform, they basically... they did away with it for a lot of people, and that's we're becoming bankruptcy laws is this is in the American tradition, the idea of starting afresh, getting a, you know, of having mercy on people who, you know, doing away with debtors' prisons. This is what America is about, and the Republicans just did away with that.
Except for the big guys, Tom, huh?
What?
The big fellas still can use bankruptcy. Uh-huh. And
corporations can, yeah. And if you're a wealthy individual, there's a million ways out of it.
Yeah.
It's for average people are going to be caught by this, and it's going to be really, really, really hard for them. But you know, that's where their heart is. They're in favor of, you know, usury is okay. You know, credit card companies charging people phenomenal interest rates, that's okay. But yep. Mercy and forgiveness, that's out.
We have some more time for callers to come in at 469-0500, 866-625-9378. And it's 866-625-WERU. Tom, what's your next project?
Well, the previous caller asked, what do we do? How do we beat these guys? And that's my project. That's what I'm working on now. I'm coming up with a strategy. Damn it.
Yeah. We have a couple more callers. I didn't realize. Go ahead. Go ahead, caller. Are you there?
Hello?
Yes, your name.
Hi.
And where are you from?
Linda in Southwest Harbor. Tom, bear with me for a minute. I'm going to take a little different tact on this. Would you be able to share with the listening audience the names of the last three books you've really enjoyed reading?
Yeah, we left out Boob Jubilee.
Boob Jubilee, that's one that I wrote.
Prefaced by Studs Terkel, by the way.
Sorry?
Studs Terkel wrote the foreword to that.
That's right, he did. Studs Terkel, he's a great man. Three books that I really enjoyed. This is a problem because I basically read books for a living now. And enjoying them is, that's tough. let's see. Well, I'm reading H.L. Mencken's book Newspaper Days right now, and I love it. It's his sort of autobiography, or part two of his autobiography. I was reading a book about 20th century populism. It's about, you know, radical farmer movements in the 20s and 30s by John Hicks. I was reading that. That's pretty good. I mean, it's not enjoyable. You know, he was an academic historian.
But what are you writing, Tom? You got another book in the oven?
Yeah, about what we do next, about how you beat
how
you beat the wingers. And what else have I read that I really enjoyed? Let me just think for a second. Isn't that funny that I have to think about it, because I read so much stuff, and a lot of the stuff that I read is just crap. You know, like I've got Ann Coulter's new book sitting here.
That's on my desk. So
yeah,
we do have another caller. While you think of Tom, go ahead, caller.
Hello, can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
All right. Well. Real quick and simple, I just wanted to say that my father is a small farmer, also self-employed. He has other work since that doesn't provide all the money, and he spends as much time as he can. He didn't vote for Bush. He does believe economic issues are should be, you know, one of the basic platforms as far as, you know, considering political issues, and as far as I know, he's in favor of market. And I was just curious if you could recap just maybe a few quick important points as to why you disagree, as far as maybe myths and fallacies, or just logical explanations of why it wouldn't work or doesn't work, or is bad for people.
Work? Why what doesn't work, your caller?
Oh, well, it just sounded like you weren't for the free market at all. So I just was curious if you could just...
Well,
I kind of missed the beginning.
You know, people use the phrase... first of all, good question, because, you know, it should be clarified. The U.S. is a capitalist country and has always been one, but there are different gradations of capitalism, and the sort of heavily regulated, or not even, it wasn't heavily regulated, but the regulated welfare state capitalism that we had in the 40s, 50s, and 60s was, in my opinion, preferable to the sort of more free market capitalism. I use the phrase free market or laissez-faire capitalism to describe the system that we're under right now, as opposed to the system that we were under before, say, 1980. And there is there has been a very real change. I mean, there it's sometimes in Europe they use the phrase neoliberalism to describe the change, but that obviously is extremely confusing in America because that implies, you know, that Margaret Thatcher is a liberal.
Really talking about total deregulation, though.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm talking about deregulated free market laissez-faire capitalism, and why it doesn't work. There's countless examples. The one of the best ones these days is the deregulation of electricity, where I was writing about this before it even happened, and this is something that it's an industry that is not suited to the free market. It's what they call a natural monopoly, but the you got to understand when you're talking to the people who make economic policy in this country, they really are in the grip of a superstition about the free market. Free market forces are always better in every situation. And then they go, you know, you talk to the Wall Street Journal or you read the Wall Street Journal op-ed page, it goes much farther than that. The free market is God. The free market is the voice of the people. The free market is democracy. And so to get rid of, to deregulate, to privatize, to get rid of labor unions, to do all these things is not only to enact the will of God, you know, to set the invisible hand free, but also to enact the will of the people. And they really believe this stuff. This is all over the place in the 1990s.
If I can break in and just invoke the father of capitalism, he wrote the book The Theory of Moral Sentiments, and he goes into great detail about the downside of the free market system.
Adam Smith. Well, there's numerous capitalist thinkers that do. You think of Schumpeter. What was his first name? I forget. Austrian economist.
Hey, Tom, let me break in. We got two. We got about 7 minutes.
Can I just say what his term was?
Absolutely.
Creative destruction. He says the free market is creative, but the downside of it is it ruins people's lives. You have to seek a balance. You have to control that.
We got two more calls.
Next caller, could we hear from you? No.
Hello.
Yes. What's your name?
Hi. This is Gray in Hancock.
Okay, Gray.
I would like to ask Mr. Frank why he is so supportive of the Democrats. They really, in their whole history, they really haven't ever stood for anything. They've latched on opportunistically to various things that have happened, starting with the Civil War, when they latched onto the resentment against the Republicans in the South, and that was the basis of their power for most of the 20th century, and they latched on to the labor unions when the labor unions were starting their own movement with no help from the major parties, thank you. And they latched on to the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, which started with no help from the major parties, thank you. And now the Republicans have managed to regain their natural consistency, which is the sort of fascist substratum of, in the South. And they've taken with their money, which they've always been more involved in than the Democrats, although the Democrats are almost as wealthy as the Republicans. They've taken over the media, and they've bamboozled everyone else. But the Democrats don't really stand for anything. They're opportunistic.
Great.
That's why they're not in power now, and why they're not going to be in power for the foreseeable future. And I would like to hear you talk about the possibility of starting another people's movement, an alternative, so-called alternative political parties, and something that's going to change the system because it's busted. And
okay, great. We have 3 minutes left. Let's give Tom a chance
to
answer your question.
Yeah, the Democrats are not the most. They don't have the most wonderful history of obviously, but they you know, they aren't the party of slavery anymore, and they do. Look, the thing is, whether or not you can operate through a third party. And my heroes in Kansas, of course, were the populist movement in the 1890s, and they did actually force the opportunistic Democrats to adopt a lot of their positions on issues, the sort of left wing economic positions, and that's how the Democrats became the liberal party that we know them as today. However, after populism was beaten, in states all over the country, they passed laws making it impossible to ever do what the populists did again, basically making third-party activity illegal, or not illegal, but impossible. And New York State is one of the states that doesn't have this, and there's a group there called the, what is it, the Working Families Party that's been very successful endorsing candidates and doing this sort of thing, and I'm very much in favor of that kind of activity. But in the absence of that, I don't see, you know, there is no other way to participate except for through the Democratic Party right now. Look, in where I grew up, Kansas has always been a Republican state, but we had a lot of liberal Republicans. And that made sense, Kansas, you know, because of the Civil War identification. You know, we were the people in Missouri; those were the Democrats. They came over and killed people in Kansas. So we were Republicans because of the Civil War, but Kansas had liberal Republicans. Now those are all gone now. You don't see too many of them anymore. But if I had a choice, you know, if that option was still available, that's a very attractive option to me. Liberal Republican.
Tom, can you wrap it up in about 30 seconds?
Me?
Yeah, give us your last final comment.
Now you wrap it up.
We want to mention that the book is What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America by Thomas Frank, and your publisher is Metropolitan Books. And also, what about the Baffler magazine?
We're working on a new issue now. It's really good.
And is there some way they can contact
your
website?
Yeah, it's thebaffler.com, or go to tcfrank.com, which has all my various essays and stuff are indexed there.
Very good.
TC, those are my initials, tcfrank.com.
One Market Under God and Conquest of Cool and Boob Jubilee, those are all still on the market, are they not?
That's right. Boob Jubilee is actually really good. I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about that, but maybe some other time.
We'd love to have you back, Tom. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks so much for being with us.
All right, anytime,
and thank you,
guys.
Callers, for calling in.
This has been Behind the Soundbite on WERU 89.9, Blue Hill 102.9, Bangor. Behind the Soundbite is the last Tuesday every month at 10 o'clock in the morning. Once again, thank you for our callers. Thank you, Chuck. Thanks to Thomas Frank.